We're looking at the case of Moran Butler versus Industrial Claim Appeals Office, and I take it that you are the counsel who represent the parties in this case. Is that correct? Okay, and as I understand it, you've been given a copy of our oral argument procedures. Do you have any questions about those procedures? Okay, thank you. When you come to the podium, you've identified yourself. Please add your attorney registration number. And I don't think we have anybody in the audience to turn off their cell phones or pagers. With that, we can begin.
Good morning. I'm Jennifer Bissett. I represent the claimant. My registration number is 13150. This is a long disputed matter. It began in 2004 concerning the claimant's average weekly wage. The respondents admitted that she was permanently totally disabled and she has not been able to work since 2001. So the determination of permanent total disability benefits sets her benefits for the rest of her life based on the wages she was earning at the time of her injury. My job in representing the claimant is to maximize her benefits, and that includes increasing it, if possible, by the cost of continuing employer's health insurance. So when there was an admission for permanent total disability benefits in March of 2004, we applied for hearing on the issue of average weekly wage to include the cost of continuing the employer's health insurance, which was provided to the claimant, and it also included her children. That was challenged at hearing by respondents on the grounds that MIDBO controlled that unless she actually paid for the benefits, it wouldn't be added. We appealed that to ICAP. ICAP affirmed the judge, and we appealed it to the Court of Appeals, and Judge Daly wrote the opinion on that, stating that consistent with the Supreme Court decision in Ray versus Liberty Mutual and the Industrial Claims Office, that whether the claimant pays for health insurance or not is to be included in average weekly wage. And the order from the Court of Appeals in 2005 remanded with directions that the claimant's average weekly wage was to include the cost of continuing the employer's health insurance. We argued that before the ALJ, we argued it to ICAP, we argued it to the Court of Appeals, including the information about the exact amount of those benefits. On remand, after the conclusion of the Supreme Court decision in the Ray case, the respondents filed a final admission admitting for the increase in average weekly wage, taking into account the cost of continuing the employer's health insurance. As I understand it, the mandate rule requires the lower court, in this case the Office of Administrative Courts, to follow what the Court of Appeals has ruled, which was to increase it based on the cost of continuing the employer's health insurance.
Do we even get to that, counsel? Is this even an appealable order at this point? Because didn't the panel remand it back for further determinations related to these issues to the ALJ?
Your Honor, I thought we addressed that in the show cause order.
I understand you didn't. We haven't ruled on it yet, have we, counsel?
You
so
have
I'm
not.
Still asking you about
you
it.
You have not. Well, the predicament that we're in is that this debate over the claimant's average weekly wage and the benefits to which she is entitled has been going on since 2004, which in my view now has gone into a trajectory that misinterprets the Court of Appeals order. I think you have unique jurisdiction to determine whether your order means what it says. So what we're asking for here is for you to affirm your order that the claimant's average weekly wage is to be determined based on the cost of continuing the employer's health insurance, that the respondents had the opportunity to raise the issue that a substitute measure should be, as the substitute meaning Medicare, should be the basis for calculating average weekly wage, which they didn't do. So once it goes through this whole appeal process, it went up to the Supreme Court and certiorari was denied, that issue is final. There's nothing that's changed. The claimant became entitled to Social Security disability in 2001 based on an award in 2004. It takes 30 months or 2 years to become qualified for Medicare. At the time that she was awarded Social Security disability, she was entitled to Medicare. Respondents never brought that issue up. So what I'm suggesting to you is that, you know, we were relying on the Court of Appeals in making a final decision about what was to be included in the calculation of the claimant's average weekly wage. That has gone into a procedural spiral that has really been a hair-pulling experience for me to try and sort out what this claimant is entitled to be paid. There are offsets, there are underpayments, there are claimed overpayments. We submitted calculations on all of that, and the respondents were directed by the Division of Workers' Compensation as to how they should go about that.
And I am aware from that, from reading the briefs and looking at the record. The question I have is, how do we get jurisdiction over this issue to enforce the mandate rule if it's not a final order yet, because there are yet determinations to be made by the ALJ?
You know, Judge, that's a really good question. And, you know, I didn't find any cases in the state beyond the Hardesty versus Pino case that addressed the issue. I didn't find anything on it. You know, the mandate rule was something new to me. I argued issue preclusion. I argued collateral estoppel and the underlying proceedings following the remand. And I don't think I've seen another case in the state of Colorado prior to February of 2009 talking about the mandate rule.
I gather that what the issue is and what your argument would be is that the so-called mandate rule that you're referring to, i.e., a court has the independent authority to enforce its own order, is an exception to the final order rule under the statute.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that issue, you say, you've been able to find no cases upon?
Not in this state.
Have you found them in other states?
I did some research yesterday, and I pulled up a rather thick, one moment, I think I brought it with me. I hope I brought it with me. I'm a little rattled this morning, and I probably was a little rattled when I left the office.
Can you set the clock for just a second?
Sure.
No, just until you're ready.
Okay.
Until you're ready.
Federal Practice and Procedure, it's written by Charles Wright and Arthur Miller. They have a chapter on res judicata. They have a section on law of the case mandate rule. 50 pages.
Well, but does res judicata have anything at all to do with this? The decision of this court was in the same case.
I don't understand.
Only applies where you're trying to impose, if you will, the decision of a court in another case to the existing case. And here, the decision that was made was in the same case that we're here again on.
Exactly.
So the res judicata wouldn't apply. Isn't it simply a question whether the either the ALJ or the panel complied with the direct orders contained in the mandate?
Yes, sir.
And that doesn't really involve res judicata. It involves what we said.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I agree. And I think this case has become incredibly convoluted because of the failure by the Office of Administrative Courts to follow the Court of Appeals order. It, you know, when we applied for hearing after the mandate came down, all we were looking for was an accounting based on the time periods of the benefits, because they changed over time. First the claimant's off work, then she's back to work, then there's a period of permanent partial disability, then there's a period of total disability or temporary total disability after that. Then there's an award of Social Security disability benefits. Then there's this award that increases the claimant's average weekly wage. So there are, and I've detailed them in, well, at least my Rule 10.06 summary, you know, how they should each be calculated. It's really an accounting issue. That's what we were looking for on remand, was let's go back, take a look at each period of benefits and make sure there's properly calculated. As I understand the Workers' Compensation Act, when there's a remand from the appeals court, those benefits need to be processed and recalculated based on the appellate order within 30 days, and any back due benefits are paid. Our position was there was an underpayment, and that underpayment should have been satisfied. But instead, we got into reopening of the Court of Appeals order, we got into increasingly complex interpretations of what that means based on the facts of this case. So it's, I don't know. You know, part of it is funny to me, but it makes me think about the kids that used to live next door to me, and they're outside one night, playing tag out with their dad. And you're safe if you're touching the car, you're safe if you're touching the tree, and you're safe if you're on the front porch. And the little boy, who was the youngest, kept losing, so he kept changing the rules so he could win. And it kind of feels like that's what's going on here with the respondents, that they lost, they have to increase the average weekly wage, they refuse to go back and recalculate the benefits, and here we are again, 5 years later with an unresolved issue.
Pardon me, Ms. Bislett, let me see if I can get right to the heart of this
so that
I can understand this, okay? As my understanding is, you're taking a sentence out of the Court of Appeals' previous order that says that it's remanded with directions to include the cost of continuing, quote, the employer's group health insurance.
Correct.
Right. And so it's my understanding that your position is that the ALJ messed up by, instead of it applying that, the words employer's group health insurance to mean COBRA, changing it to the social SSDI. Is that correct?
Almost. It's not SSDI, it's Medicare.
Medicare. All right. So essentially what you're saying is we have now jurisdiction to reach in to the midst of this proceeding that's going on between ICAP and the ALJ, even though it's been remanded, to say what we meant or what the division meant when it said employers group health insurance was COBRA and not Medicare.
Yes, ma'am.
That's what you want us to do.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Assuming that's what you want us to do, isn't there some possibility, at least, that on remand, the ALJ could do that without our intervening? And aren't we supposed to wait until the remand is done and it bounces back to us? I understand your frustration.
I don't think so, because the ALJ's entered his order. It's changed the whole posture of the case, and ICAP not only affirmed that, but they came up with new grounds for sending it back for recalculation.
Okay,
based
so
on an alleged
question,
based
then.
On an alleged overpayment issue.
Is it possible that the division just used an imprecise word that has caused this whole problem? Isn't it possible that what was really intended by the Court of Appeals' previous order was that it would be either Medicare or COBRA, whatever, applied?
My position on that is whether it should have been Medicare or COBRA was an issue that was ripe in June of 2004. Respondents did not argue that it was measured by Medicare. That was a ripe issue. They didn't bring it forward. We argued throughout our appeal that it's the cost of continuing employers' health insurance, which is something different. Now, I know that they brought up the Skelly case. In the Skelly case, they actually preserved the issue whether it should be Medicare or the cost of continuing the employer's health insurance.
But if your client was no longer eligible for COBRA at the time that this all came up, why does she get paid for COBRA as opposed to the other? Isn't that just a windfall?
Judge, I'm an advocate, and I'm here to try and maximize my client's benefits. There's no question about that. And it makes a big difference to her whether it's based on the cost of COBRA, it's based on Medicare. But I think whether it's based on Medicare is something that the respondents had an obligation to preserve at the time the issue came up in June of 2004. Instead, they took an all-or-nothing position, that MDBO precluded her from having any increase in her average weekly wage because she didn't pay for the cost of continuing employers' health insurance. So, you know, do I argue that Medicare can be the measure of the claimant's average weekly wage? When that issue has been properly preserved, I think it can be. I don't think it was in this case. I think we're entitled to rely on the order of the Court of Appeals, which was specific. There's nothing that's changed since this issue was ripe in June of 2004 in terms of the claimant's eligibility for Medicare. They should have brought it up and they didn't. So yeah, I am relying on the Court of Appeals order that it carries forward. And I don't know that it's much of a windfall, because when you take out Social Security disability and they get credit for 50% of what she receives for herself and her two dependent children, you know, it's a difference between $138 per week versus $240 per week, and it's not a minor difference. It's not a minor difference for her. She's impaired for life. She had a low back injury, she had surgery, and she has what they call arachnoiditis, which is internal scarring, a painful condition. She hasn't been able to return to work. And sure, I'm telling you, I'm an advocate. I'm here to try and advocate for the maximum amount of benefits, not the least amount. I think under the posture of this case, that's what should happen, and what would clear this up is if you enforced your mandate And all we do is go back and properly calculate the benefits, because there's a lot of unexplained periods here. There's an application for a lump sum, and I don't dispute that they get credit for overpayments, but they've never accounted for it. So yeah, it's frustrating. It is really frustrating. And I can see that if you don't clarify this on remand from here, we're going to be back in 2 years, and it still won't be resolved. So help us out. I guess I have 24 seconds.
Yes, you do.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Joanne Prebison. I represent the respondents in the court below. My registration number is 29484. With the issue of this court's show cause order, respondents obviously adopted the Hardesty v. Pino analysis put forth by the claimant with regard to the mandate rule, and we won't rehash those arguments here. After looking more closely at case law regarding final orders, this court cited Ortiz, which held that an order by an ALJ striking the claimant's request for a division IME was not final. And that, to me, is very distinguishable from what we have here before the court. It is an order by the ALJ ordering the respondents to file a final admission and pay benefits in accord with a final admission based on this much average weekly wage for this time period based on COBRA, and then this much going for based on Medicare, and that was a final order. And then ICAP visited the issue and said, not only that, we're going to go one step further, and we're going to allow the respondents to go back and take this as an overpayment retroactively under 843.303, reopening provisions allowing respondents to collect overpayments or to recalculate average weekly wage. The best way concrete case, which is 984 P2D 680, and that's Colorado Court of Appeals 1999, says it is not necessary that all aspects of a claim be ruled upon for an order to be final for the purposes of judicial review, only that the order requires a party to either pay benefits or it denies benefits. And so I'm not sure that we even get to Hardesty v. Pino, which gives us another layer of argument for why this court
and
should
I gather
take jurisdiction.
Your point then, or the conclusion would be, I gather, that the ALJ's decision or the ICAP's decision collectively to substitute Medicare for employer insurance was in effect a denial of benefits.
Yes. In effect, it would be because
even though the benefits to be awarded have not yet been computed, that the decision denying employer insurance increase was a denial of benefits, and therefore that order is appealable now.
I believe that's the case, Your Honor. The respondents argued at hearing extensively that if retroactive relief would apply, meaning that we would go back and recalculate average weekly wage for those periods from the time the claimant received Medicare January 1, 2004 forward, that if we did it under that standard, that we would be entitled to an overpayment. And at this point, we definitely are entitled to an overpayment because we're going on 2 years from the hearing. Respondents continue to pay benefits at the higher COBRA rate, which is very prejudicial to them, given the case law gives them the right to reduce benefits or increase average weekly wage depending on the claimant's circumstances.
Made those retroactive determinations?
I'm sorry?
Has the ALJ made those retroactive or determinations based on retroactivity?
What the ALJ's order said, what Judge Haar's order said, Your Honor, was that respondents, although they did demonstrate that by January 1st, 2004, the claimant was receiving Medicare and that would have reduced the rate, that under HLJ Management v. Kim, which is a case involving withdrawal of admission of liability, that we would only have prospective relief.
Right. And the panel said, no, you could have retroactive relief too. Has the ALJ gone back and made the calculations and made the award for retroactive relief?
No, Your Honor, they have not.
Okay. Okay, if we can reach the merits here, Why isn't the issue waived as far as being able to use the Medicare part? Because as I recollect, the briefs in the prior appeal were filled with COBRA versus nothing, not COBRA versus Medicare versus nothing.
The claimant's main argument for waiver was actually raised as a matter of issue preclusion.
Let's bring you back to my question.
Okay.
My question was, if you knew in 2004, getting Medicare, and their position was, we're entitled to have it COBRA, augmented by the COBRA amount. Your position in 2004 was not, no, you're entitled Medicare amount. It was, no COBRA. And that looks like it was the position in the first appeal in this case.
No,
COBRA versus nothing.
I disagree with that characterization, Your Honor. At the hearing in 2004, the issue was whether the claimant was entitled to add anything to average weekly wage where the claimant did not elect or purchase continuing health coverage once her health coverage terminated under the employment. And at the time, the case law was very clear. We were operating under the Midbo decision. And in fact, the court at the hearing stated that the Midbo applied and that her hands were tied. Judge Coughlin said, we can't do anything about this. And that was the end of the argument. At that point, respondents had no incentive to sit around arguing and picking apart what cost it would be, because the law was very clear at that time to the respondents that under the Midbo decision, the claimant gets no cost added to her average weekly wage. And we don't have the same incentive to litigate this, the other issues, whether they were known or not. There's also, the record in this case supports that the respondents, by the time we got a decision on do we add or do we not add in a case where the claimant has not elected and or purchased any continuing health coverage, by the time we get that decision 3 years down the road, the respondents did not have knowledge of the premium costs. Their hands would have been tied anyway as to whether to file an admission. And they filed an admission in January, which they added in COBRA. In February, they filed another admission, but it was in response to the director raising some issues about the first one. And in that second admission, which is part of the exhibits in the record, Your Honor, on February 22nd, 2007, second final admission, the respondents put a statement in there saying, we don't know what the Medicare premium is, but once we find out, we have a right to amend this and to change the average weekly wage pursuant to whatever the Medicare cost of the premium was.
Counsel, let me ask you this question. I think it goes without saying that the ICAP decision and the decision by the ALJ, whichever one you want to look at, does not literally comply with the mandate of this court. Would you agree? I guess what I'm saying is, under no interpretation that I'm aware of, could you say that a Medicare contribution is the cost of an employer's insurance group policy, whereas that's true of COBRA. In fact, there's no change in insurance under COBRA. It's the same policy, isn't it?
No, there would be, yes, but if COBRA eventually runs out after 18 months.
I understand that, but I'm saying the mandate of this court was specific in referring to the cost of the employer's insurance policy.
Well, there was another sentence in that order of remand too, Your Honor, to the extent that cost is disputed, the parties may have a hearing.
Well, fair enough, but the nature of the cost was the employer's insurance policy, correct? Isn't
yes.
that specifically what was said by the mandate?
The mandate said that the court would be directed to add in, or the respondents were directed to add in, the cost of continuing the employer's health coverage. And that is language that is tracked in the statute under the Carnell Ray case and under the Shelley case.
Well, on what basis? The ALJ said that he could get into the Medicare on the basis of the reopening provision. Am I not correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And do you have any other basis for the ALJ to change the mandate of this court?
Well, I believe, Your Honor, that we could withdraw that admission and get a hearing at any time based on a mistake or new information or information regarding the Medicare premium.
What was the mistake other than failing to raise the issue?
The mistake, first of all, final admissions are not judgments. So we're dealing with...
No, I'm not talking about that.
Okay.
If the only basis for the change from employer's insurance policy to Medicare is the reopening provision,
mm-hmm.
and you claim that the reopening provision allowed you to reopen because of, quote, mistake, unquote, what was the mistake other than your prior failure to raise the issue?
The mistake was on the part of respondent's adjuster that after 3 years of this case lingering in the Court of Appeals, she filed an admission to hurry to comply with the order of remand.
Okay.
She did not.
And what I'm saying is the mistake was the failure to raise the Medicare issue previously, right?
Yes, that was the mistake.
All right, now let me ask you this. Take this scenario. Let's assume you have a workers' compensation hearing that results in a final order, okay? And 18 months later, one of the parties says, hey, we forgot to raise an issue. Can you apply the reopening statute to that scenario?
I believe that this situation is highly distinguishable from what Your Honor is
that
saying.
That may be true, but answer my question. Could you apply the reopening statute to that scenario?
Yes, because under 843.303, the statute clearly states that at any time 2 years after benefits become due and or payable, that a case may be reopened under certain grounds, including fraud, overpayment, and mistake. And
okay.
Mistake has been interpreted as a unilateral mistake.
Okay, fair enough. And you're saying that a failure to raise an issue is a mistake under the statute, so there's no reason to raise an issue until 2 years after the final judgment.
There was no reason to raise the issue of Medicare at the point that the claimant says we should have raised it, because the law was clear. Then we received an order of remand in January of 07, and 20 days later, the adjuster filed the admission, and then it was called to her attention that the claimant had received Medicare. We immediately turned around and said no at that point and filed another admission. At that point, the claimant had objected on other grounds, and that left the whole matter of the final admission open under the case law, because the claimant requested a hearing within 30 days on other issues. We filed a response and said, we believe that Medicare is the issue here. And in our response to application for hearing, we clearly stated that we didn't know what the premium was. There was no way to file an admission without knowledge of the premium, because we couldn't calculate the benefit. But we did make the claim within less than 30 days after the first admission, saying, whoops, wait a minute, we have an issue here with Medicare versus COBRA. And the reopening statute is a statutory scheme that it contemplates a just result that prevents this kind of windfall that the claimant would receive in this case. I want to point the court to a case of called Rocky Mountain Cardiology versus Industrial Claims Appeals Panel, 94P3rd, 1182.
Is that cited in your brief, counsel?
I don't believe it was cited in our brief.
I think our orders suggest that these cases need to be sent to us and to opposing counsel 7 days before oral argument. I would suggest in the future that you adhere to our orders on that. Counsel, stop the clock. Thank you. Counsel, would you like, let's see, today's Tuesday. Could you get us by, would you like 3 days to respond to us by letter, unless you're aware of this case? Are you aware of this case that counsel is speaking
about? I have it with me. I looked at
it. Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, I will give you till Friday to file a two-page letter in response to any comments counsel has to make with respect to it that you want us to consider in making our decision.
But it's not required.
Yeah, but it's not required.
It's a two-page letter.
Two-page letter addressed to all three of us.
Okay.
And it's at your option. It is, as Judge Terry reminded me, it's not required, but you have the opportunity to do so if you'd like to do so. Okay, please proceed.
I apologize, Your Honor, that this case was not brought to the court's attention earlier. In the case of Rocky Mountain Cardiology, the court stated that equitable principles, such as, and this was an estoppel case, waiver and estoppel, cannot be used to circumscribe the rights conferred by the workers' compensation statute. The cases cited by claimant in her brief include prominently Johnson versus Industrial Commission, where the Colorado Supreme Court that held an offset for Social Security disability may be taken retroactively under the statute. The court contained, had opinions that contained some dicta about waiver and about the timely raising of issues. And in this case, first of all, what ICAP said about the claimant, claimant's arguments at hearing did not adequately raise the issue of waiver to begin with. But even if, even if arguably those issues were raised, that the respondent somehow waived this argument that we can never ever go back and adjust for the Medicare premium. The record doesn't support that because, again, we had a situation where the law was very clear in, at the 2004 hearing that the issue was whether or not to add anything at all or not to add it. And respondents were clearly in this position where the law was don't add if the claimant did not elect for any of her COBRA coverage or did not purchase similar or lesser insurance plan, which was the facts of this case. So at that time, there was no reason for the parties to argue at the hearing because the court at the hearing made it clear that they would apply the Midbo decision. And there was no opportunity at that point to hash out what would be the COBRA for how long or what period of time it would be. And then 3 years went by while we were awaiting a decision in the Carnell Ray case, which the Colorado Supreme Court said, it doesn't matter if the claimant elects COBRA or purchases insurance, we're going to make that money available. And after the Ray decision was handed down, then we received this order of remand, and the order of remand stated, to the extent that there's a dispute over what the cost of actually continuing that health coverage in a similar or lesser plan, then the parties may have a hearing. The claimant applied for a hearing within 30 days after the first final admission, and all the issues were opened up at that point, and we stated.
Counsel, and I see your time has expired. I have a question. The other judges may have a question as well. Is it your position that the reopening statute independently justifies the consideration of Medicare at this point in time, regardless of the mandate rule?
Yes.
Was that a leading question? It might have been. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Any other questions?
I guess I would just follow up with why.
Because the statutory scheme for workers' compensation cases, and the case law has a lot to say about how this statutory scheme promotes a just result and acknowledges that things change along the way. The sort of joke in my line of work in workers' comp is that a workers' compensation case is never closed, ever, unless you have a full and final settlement. It's just never closed. Things will change in this case as we go. The claimant is now permanently and totally disabled, but the reopening statute says that if we discover fraud or that she is working or earning wages over $3,000 or $4,000 a year at some point, we can reopen for those issues. The reopening statute is very clear that any award can be reopened on certain grounds. And here we have two grounds, overpayment and mistake. And the mistake was one that was made and quickly considered, and the claimant was notified very quickly of the mistake in January of 07.
Thank you, counsel. Any other questions? You. Thank you, counsel, for your
Thank
argument.
You.
Ms. Counsel, you have 22 seconds, plus you get to answer the question I just asked.
Okay, thanks. I agree with Ms. Carbassar that cases can be reopened even after a court of appeals has ruled on an issue, but that is where there is a change in information. For instance, like she said, maybe the claimant went back to work. That there's something new, something has changed. What we're dealing with here is a case where the information was fixed in June of 2004 when these issues were presented to the administrative law judge. There's nothing that's changed. So from that standpoint, I disagree with her that this case can be reopened. And our position has been that the ALJs did not have the power to reopen the issue of average weekly wage following the mandate. And the question I have for you is, and the reason that we're here is, does a court of appeals have any effect in these cases? I mean, what point do your rulings go down and they have to follow them?
Thank you, counsel.
And one more thing. I really had some formatting problems when I did my opening brief. You know, when you're under a crunch and you want to get it filed on time, I read it last night and go, oh boy, I want to apologize, too, if it looked like a mess. I think the arguments came across, but I want to do something to make sure that my briefs are better prepared in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you for your arguments in this case. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. And you have until Friday, as we